Good morning. We're here today to share with you our work called School Obesity Related Policy Evaluation Study, in affectionately known to us as SCOPE, Project SCOPE. These are the learning objectives for the entire session. And first, I'd like to acknowledge our team of our researchers today, of which four of us are here, but of course we have a larger team with the on the project, but the presenters today have no conflicts of interest to report. And I'd also like to highlight the funding, just to share a little bit about the funding. Our collective work first started off with some pilot work from funds from the Minnesota Population Center, and that really laid some foundation. And then we received some Robert Wood Johnson Healthy Eating Research Funds that really helped us establish a broader perspective on this work that we'll share today. And then that led into a five-year R01 funded by the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development. So I'll kick it off today about talking about really the million-dollar question: are school food and activity policies effective? And I'll share with you what we're doing in our state, Minnesota, and what we feel is really relevant and doable in other states. I was first struck back in 2005 by that Sentinel publication from the Institute of Medicine. It was the first time I'd ever been exposed to the idea that policy interventions at that time really need to proceed according to the best available evidence, and that's how that we were proceeding. And that took me a while for that to sink in and me to be comfortable with that philosophy moving forward, that we're really operating in the policy arena around the best available evidence in terms of schools. I was further struck 7 years later, last month, when I saw an article led by Tom Farley, so in September last month, repeating basically the same thing, that both policy intervention research and policy evaluation research can need to really occur simultaneously, because we cannot wait to respond to an epidemic of this magnitude until all questions are answered. 7 years later, so that really struck me as the state of where we still are in terms of school policy evaluation. And this is why the epidemic, the prevalence rates among adults and youth as of 2009 and 10, with really not any decline since 2003. And as a result, we've had a number of federal laws and national initiatives and state and local efforts targeting schools. But despite that, over this seven-year period, the current evidence evaluating the effectiveness of school policies and practices, at least upon students' weight status, is still deemed inconclusive and weak and insufficient during the same time period. So just briefly, this next slide is a little bit about that, the literature. Most of it is descriptive in nature. We have lots of great, very informative and interesting studies on the prevalence of school policies and practices and the concordance between state laws and how they're being operationalized in districts and the policy strengths that are available or out there relate for schools, the disparities in the prevalences and changes in law. So before the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act and policies afterwards. That's where the preponderance of the evidence is. To a much lesser extent, we have some evaluations of the associations between school environments and student behaviors, like diet and activity behaviors. Mostly have been limited to, mostly been promising, with positive relationships between the availability of competitive foods and sugar, sweetened beverages, and student consumption. To a much less extent around physical activity policies and practices in schools and the impact on or the association with student activity behaviors. And we just still today have only a very small handful of evaluation, school policy evaluation studies, examining the association between those environments and student overweight. Again, the million-dollar question. And there are a handful of promising studies that identify an inverse relationship between food policies and student overweight, and mostly as policies and practices related to competitive foods and to sugar sweetened beverages go up, that we see some associations with student overweight going down. But still a very small handful. And once again, policies and practices linked to outcomes related to physical activity are really very, very far and few in between. So in summary, in terms of research gaps in this area, I would characterize the literature as descriptive rather than evaluative. Single policies or sets of similar policies have been evaluated, and they've been primarily food and nutrition focused, with really a lot of absence around physical activity policies and practices. They're rarely linked to weight outcomes, and just a very small handful, and they've mostly been conducted with short time frames. I would like to take this time to highlight one of the studies that this team is engaged in that really does set the foundation for the work we'll describe today. It was a cross-sectional snapshot, again, trying to add to the literature of linking policies to youth obesity in school settings. It's at the state level, and we use the SHIP's 2006 policy level data. Our goal here with this work was to really start to examine the school environment from a more comprehensive lens, to really look at the full environment. We took a lot of time to describe the school environment in terms of food and nutrition policies. We had about 100 to work from through those SHIP studies, about 146 of the physical activity and education policies, and a couple weight assessment policies. In this cross-sectional state-level snapshot, we did identify significant positive associations between the total food and nutrition environment in schools and youth obesity. So as policies went up, weight went up, or as weight went up, policies went up, at least in our cross-sectional study. And I've got my next slide, I'll share a little bit more about that. This study also gave us was the first time that we had a glimpse of the idea where we plotted school-level policy scores, environment scores with youth obesity prevalence. It was the first time that we saw a pattern of perhaps there was something to be said about the moderately environment scores and moderate youth or lower youth obesity prevalence weights. And I'll share a little bit more about that as well. This is just a quick snapshot to show the breadth of the comprehensive environment we were able to look at in that paper, where in that particular snapshot, the total food and nutrition environment plus collaboration and competitive food environments were linked with youth obesity rates, but we again did not see anything for physical activity in that small study. So all of that has led up to the aim of our grant and our scope study, and that is to answer the question or to examine the association between policy and practice environments and student level BMI percentile. And we do have a hypothesis that it may be something there with the comprehensiveness of it, of the policy and practice environments and student BMI percentiles. The scope study is guided by a conceptual model that really appreciates that school policies, school level policies, are impacted by the federal legislation and national initiatives, which impact states and their policies and practices, in fact, impact districts and so on down to the school level. And it's this overall policy environment that consists of various nutrition and food practices and policies, physical activity and education policies that ultimately impact student behavior within those schools and hopefully will at least moderate BMI. We recognize there'll be some school level differences around location, geographic location and size, and we recognize there may be some variations among genders and free and reduced meal eligibility of those students in those schools. So the scope study design, we're going to address our study aim with a multi-year cross-sectional study using Minnesota middle and junior high schools, about 300 of them, and 6th, 9th, and 12th grade Minnesota youth that are attending those schools. We have three primary data sources with which to answer our questions, and the policy level data, the school level policy data, comes from the CDC supported school health profiles, our Minnesota school health profiles. That particular instrument is a survey of principals and lead health educators in schools. It's conducted every 2 years. And this survey is a random sample of secondary schools. In the state of Minnesota, about 39% of our schools are invited to participate as a part of that random sample. And generally, although not every year, about 70% of those schools participate. For our student-level behavior and demographic data, we're pulling from our Minnesota Student Survey. This is a self-report survey administered to our 6th, 9th, and 12th graders in our state. It's conducted every 3 years. And unlike the random sample with the profile or policy data, it's conducted as a statewide census. And in our state, 90% of schools, generally over the last 10-year period, about 90% of schools participate, and about 70% of students in those schools, the 6th, 9th, and 12th graders participate. So we have excellent participation in this survey conducted every 3 years. And then we have school-level demographic data sources for that. We have spent the last year and a half getting to know our data. And one of our first, and I'm highlighting here, four activities in doing so. And one is assembling the profile schools across years. So we have these profile, every 2 years, this profiles data. And so we've lined it all up and taken a look at the schools within our sample, our scope study sample. And by doing so, we've been able to identify changes and stabilities in our school characteristics. We know that most of our schools 10 years ago, as of today, still reside in rural Minnesota. We also know, though, that more of our schools are becoming are minority serving. The trend has increased over the 10 years. And we also know that more students have become eligible for free and reduced price school meals. We also know how many schools in those repeated cross-sections, how many remained in or were consistently or consecutively in those samples just by random chance. So to produce a cohort of schools that we can examine or ask different questions of. So we know we have about 880 unique schools in our 10-year sample, and we know that at any given time the number of cohorts that are repeatedly in those in that sample. Another activity for getting to know our data is to examine the question consistency over time. We have, as you know, as surveillance surveys, they respond to changing needs of states, and this is a nice aspect, but in our case, there are some challenges that go along with this. But when examining the profiles across years, we've identified a core set of policies that span the 10 years. We know that vending machine foods available, we know those are a core set of questions across years. We also know that there are pockets where from 2006, the same set of questions were asked, but we also know that around 2008, a new set of questions started to be adding around marketing and taste testing, some very time-relevant questions adding to that survey. Another activity on getting to know our data was starting to link the student survey to the profiles or the policy surveys. Now, profiles is the limiting factor here, right? That's the random sample of schools. And MSS we have on lots and lots of schools. So we had to take some time to link how many limiting factors are profile schools and list and link to the behaviors, the student behavior data to there. And then we had asked ourselves lots of questions to make sure we understood that data. For example, are our schools any different that didn't participate in the profiles and so on. And then we spent quite a bit of time over the last year with definitions. How do you define middle school and junior high school and high school? And where does a K through 8 school fit? You can imagine the varying grade configurations of schools. So we spent a lot of time trying to really look at our data and identify definitions. Well, in that time period, we've identified two pretty significant challenges or limitations that have come about as a result of getting to know our data. And one, again, is that instrument change over time is a challenge as we move forward. There are some nuanced question changes that are very subtle and slight. There are some dropped questions. Walking and biking to school only took was only asked 1 year, and then there were some questions that were added at different time periods. So we've got those things to work with. In the student behavior data was much more stable. The one major challenge is that height and weight self-report height and weight has only started being asked in 2007, and so that proposes a challenge for us as we move forward. And then the administration of the surveys it is actually undergoing some changes in 2013, and we'll have to address those. Another summary in terms of the challenges, the analytic challenges. As you can imagine, various data sources and this different sampling years and the different sampling methods and the differential use of weighting within years all pose analytic challenges for this project. This is a sample of the analytic challenges we have. That top row is the profiles or that policy data. That bottom row is the MSS or the behavior data. And how do you link these up? Where do you start doing the linking? Do you use the policies to come before behaviors or after, or in some areas they line right up? And these are some of the challenges that actually we handle on a question-by-question basis. Given all those challenges and the limitations, and we still have some data to present today, and the others have some great data to present, and I'll present just some baseline stuff here. But this is not, this is a result of a top-notch team with a really good sense of humor, and many days it was that sense of humor and that creative thinking that really helped to get us to this point today. But the baseline data here, I won't go into it much, but this is two snapshots, 2002 and 2010 in Minnesota. These are the predictor variables or the policy variables, just a snapshot of a few. Fruits and vegetables available in school events, we see by middle school and high schools that actually has gone up over the years. Vending machine availability has gone down in middle schools, is about the same in high schools. PE required has stayed the same at 100% in sixth grade. It's gone up slightly amongst 11th grade students, and intramural activities or opportunities remained about the same. In terms of our behavioral data for middle schools and high schools, these are just a snapshot of what we have to work with. Servings of fruits and vegetables have gone up, both for middle school and high school students, and the right in a positive direction, where glasses of soda have actually gone down. These are the raw data. And then days of 30 minutes of moderate activity are basically about the same, unchanged across the last, generally in about 10 years for our study. In conclusion, SCOPE is responding to the call from an innovative and intensive school policy evaluation research. Our next steps are to take this data now and to present develop a more comprehensive lens. Maybe it's a highly comprehensive, medium, and low comprehensive policy environment, and look at outcomes based upon those varying scores. We're going to link school environments to students in those schools. That's the beauty of this work, that we can literally look at the outcomes of the students attending those schools at that time. Because of the multiple years that we have, we could start to look at some relationships over time. And just as importantly, we can start exploring variations by school demographics. Are rural schools different than suburban and urban? Student demographics, what might impact gender differently? And then this use of the existing surveillance data really offers a sustainable and cost-efficient approach that has some broad reach, both geographically and longitudinally, and most importantly, the ability to identify vulnerable populations, whether that be schools or students. And here in Minnesota, our team feels like that this approach in taking on this activity really does position Minnesota to better assist policymakers by identifying, responding more accurately and maybe more timely when decision makers are ready to make decisions, at least around school policies and practices. And with that, I'll say thank you and turn it over to my colleagues for the next set of presentations.